From WHQR Public Radio in Wilmington, North Carolina, this is Coastline. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis Hilburn. Since October, 71 people have arrived in Wilmington as refugees, most of them from the Democratic Republic of Congo. Another 20% are from Colombia, and half a dozen have fled Burma. Over the previous fiscal year, nearly 100 people resettled in the Wilmington area, most from Burma, about a quarter from Colombia. The United States, according to a new poll by Amnesty International and reported by the BBC, ranks ninth in terms of how open its citizens are to helping those fleeing war and persecution. The U.S. comes in right behind Jordan. The most welcoming countries are China, Germany, and the U.K., in that order. The least welcoming, Russia, Indonesia, and Thailand. How does the growing refugee population around the world affect southeastern North Carolina? And what is it like to be one of those people? Most Americans will never know what it means to leave behind one's homeland, learn a new language, new customs, find ways to connect with new people, create a completely new life. To learn more about the refugees and their experience in the Cape Fear region, Sarah Pascal is joining us today. She is the sub-office coordinator for Interfaith Refugee Ministry, a local nonprofit dedicated to helping people from other countries settle into life in southeastern North Carolina. Sarah Pascal, welcome to Coastline.
Thank you.
Also with us today is a case manager for Interfaith Refugee Ministry, and he understands the refugee experience firsthand. He spent more than two decades in a refugee camp in Thailand after fleeing the political unrest in Burma. Tuntun, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
And we're inviting you to join the conversation. Do you have questions about refugees in the Cape Fear region? Have you or do you know someone who has resettled here? Email your question or comment to coastline@whqr.org. You can also tweet us at @CoastlineHQR. And a little bit later in the hour, we'll open the phone lines. Tuntun, take us back to the late 1980s, 1988, I think it was, when the uprising of citizens in the country that was then known as Burma took place. What happened that day, and how did it change the direction of your life?
In 1988, I was a medical student. I participated in the 1988, we called 8888 demonstrations.
Because it was August 8th, 1988.
Correct. Yeah. So I participated in the demonstrations, and we are told that to leave the capital city, Rangoon, and 1,000 arrested, about 3,000 were killed, and we all ran away from the capital city.
You ran away from the capital city, and where did you run to?
I ran back to my hometown. It's called the capital city of a state called Karen State.
Karen State. And how long were you able to stay there before you fled that area?
When I came back to my hometown, I was arrested again. And I was beaten, tortured, and forced to carry very, very heavy ammunition. I was a teenager, so I was really afraid of, scared, and I decided to leave my hometown again, to live in the, we call, displaced area, in the jungle.
In the jungle.
Correct.
So how long were you in captivity? How, when they arrested you the second time and you were beaten and tortured, how long did it take for you to get away and flee to the jungle?
It was only 3 days arrested. We went with the military troops. They are doing the operations, carrying around with them. We experienced better gunshot, mortar shells. I was really scared and really afraid. And they released me later on. And I thought, it is not safe to stay. I can be arrested again, so I decided to leave and to go to the safe area, we think.
We think, you said, the safe area. And are you talking about the jungle at this point? You're not to the refugee camp yet. You're you're in the jungles.
Yes, I was in the jungle for about 9 months.
9 months? And how do you survive in the jungle? Did you have shelter?
No. We build our own shelters. We grow some vegetables. There are very, very few vegetables in the jungle. And also some villagers, they lived in the jungle. With the help of them, we grow vegetable. We try to find that there are a lot of food we can eat, like bamboo shoots, banana trees. They are quite delicious. I remember those food. It's not available here.
Oh, no, it's not available here. So how long, you said you spent 9 months in the jungle, and then how did you wind up in a refugee camp in Thailand?
Yes, in those days, there are fighting against ethnic minorities called Karen, rebel group, and the government troops. They shifted their strategy from face fighting to placing a landmine. There's no safe place to live on. We heard a lot of explosions, landmines. I saw a few of our friends. They were victims of landmines. And I remembered there were some medics helping the displaced persons. I remember they used coconut juice as IV, and that victim survived. That is one of my experience. And yes, because we decided it's not a safe place to live anymore, and we decided to cross the border.
So you crossed the border then into Thailand?
Yes.
And what do you encounter there?
When we first crossed the border, we saw a lot of international NGOs and the church groups welcoming, they call displaced persons. And also the Thai government involved. We lived in the temporary shelter with about 3,000 people in 1990.
Sarah Pascal of Interfaith Refugee Ministry, how common is Tuntun's story, spending all those years? And in your case, Tuntun, you spent 23 years in that refugee camp in Thailand?
Yes.
How common is that?
It's very common. Most of our clients have spent more than a decade in a refugee camp before arriving in Wilmington.
And in your case, Tuntun, you were concerned for your physical safety in the refugee camp as well?
No, refugee camp is safe.
It was safe.
Yes.
What were some of the challenges that you faced in the refugee camp?
Refugee camps, we are not allowed to go outside the camp. We were fenced and not allowed to walk. We are not allowed to be a kind of legal status, even if like a permanent resident or citizenship, and we're not allowed to. Well, we heavily depend on the international assistances. This is the very big challenges for many, many refugees for continue their lives and their hopes, especially children's education.
And that was one of the factors, your own children's education, that you were concerned about.
Yes.
And so you recognized one day. What was the day that you were in the refugee camp and you said to yourself, I have to get out of here. I can't live here anymore.
Yes. It is really getting more and more challenging because we were told to go back home again and again by the Thai government. Thai government closely with the Burmese government. They try to plan the refugee repatriation, sending them back home. And this is no safe. We cannot go back. There are a lot of landmines. What is the safe place we can live? There are a lot of fighting against ethnic minorities. We didn't see any place is safe to go back. So many, many refugees decided to resettle to the third countries. It is the third best option. The best option is to go back home. The second option is community integration to be a kind of legal resident in Thailand, but the third option is to resettle in the third country. But it's the only option, so many, many refugees decided to resettle mainly to United States.
And Sarah Pascal, what kind of pathway would someone like Tun Tun have gone through in terms of the U.S. State Department and then ultimately winding up in Wilmington, North Carolina? How did he get here?
Sure. Well, it's a very long, complicated process that happens over many years, and it's a little bit different depending on which region of the world someone is coming out of. But in general, first, they would have had to have refugee status determined by the United Nations High Commission for Refugees, showing that they are persecuted based on certain grounds, race, religion, ethnicity, social group, or political opinion. So if they're found to have fled for their life and be persecuted based on those things, they stay in a refugee camp until, like Tun Tun said, that the other options of going home don't really exist. They can't stay in that second country. The United Nations refers people for third country resettlement when there are no other options. So they would have been referred to the United States Refugee Program or a program of another country. There are more than 20 countries worldwide that do refugee resettlement. But with the United States, they would have started new batches of interviews with U.S. government officials, telling their story in detail over again to USCIS, to different government officials, making sure that they meet the U.S. definition of a refugee.
And how long would that whole process take before, say, Tun Tun actually arrived here in Wilmington?
Sure. Well, right now it's about 2 to 3 years on average from the time they get referred to the United States program until they would actually travel here.
Okay, and we'll hear more about this process when we come back from the break. You're listening to Coastline on 91.3 FM, talking about life as a refugee and the refugee population in southeastern North Carolina. If you have a question, phone lines are open, 910-343-1138. You can also email us at coastline@whqr.org. You're listening to Coastline. You're listening to Coastline. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. We're talking about refugees in the Cape Fear region, how they arrive in Wilmington, the challenges they face in building a life here. And with us to answer your questions today are Sarah Pascal. She's the sub-office coordinator for Interfaith Refugee Ministry in Wilmington, North Carolina. And Tun Tun. He is a case manager with that same nonprofit, which helps refugees resettle here. And he is also a former Burmese refugee himself. The phones are now open if you have a question for either of our guests. The number is 910-343-1138. You can also email us today at coastline@whqr.org. And Sarah Pascal, right before we went to break, you were telling us a little bit about the process and how long it takes. You said in Tun Tun's case, coming from a Thai refugee camp to the U.S., it might have taken between 2 and 3 years to gain refugee status and then actually get brought over here.
Yes, as soon as the United States gets involved, it takes at least that long, sometimes much longer depending on which region of the world, because there's such an arduous process that the government goes through to make sure that people are who they say they are, that they are not affiliated with terrorism in any way, shape, or form, that they really are meeting the definition, the U.S. definition of who a refugee is, and they have fled for their life. So they do multiple interviews. They go through background checks through many different agencies, FBI, National Counterterrorism Center, Department of Homeland Security, State Department, many different levels to show that they are safe before they're invited to finally resettle here.
Tun Tun, what year did you come to the United States? How long have you been here?
I arrived in February 13th, 2013.
So a little more than 3 years.
Correct.
Not very long at all. Sarah Pascal, have you seen any kind of ramping up of the process, of the vetting process, since concerns about terrorism around the globe have risen? Or do you think it's the same?
It's always been very strong. I think there are a lot of misconceptions out there about what has happened in the past versus now. It's always been the same. I think there's more communication about it out there now because people are questioning. But it's always been there.
Can you speak to that a little bit? Because you've said that during times when there are terrorist events in other parts of the world, you tend to get more phone calls from citizens concerned about who's coming in here. Can you talk to that a little bit?
Yeah, I think people, not everyone has a good understanding of the conditions that Tuntun and refugees have fled from, that the people that are coming through the U.S. Refugee Admissions Program are the people that are fleeing the terrorists that have caused these atrocities around the world. They've been tortured. They've seen family members killed. They've been held hostage. They've gone through unimaginable things that we can not even wrap our heads around, and that's why they're offered this chance to resettle. So I think in people's minds, they just know that bad things are happening in the other areas of the world, not sure, want to make sure that America stays safe, of course, but also continue our values of opening our doors and offering safe haven and having people move here that really can contribute to the fabric of our society.
Tuntun, when you first arrived, what were some of the things that you had to learn about this culture?
There are a lot of things I need to learn. It's completely different, the housing, living, like public transportation, and going to shopping. Everything is very completely different. We lived in the open house, built with bamboos and leaves. It is an air-conditioned house. We have to learn everything. Electric appliances, we don't know how to use exactly. So there are a lot of learning. And even if I speak English, I was really struggling at the beginning, 3 to 4 months. Oh, honestly, I don't even understand the accent here when I first came. Now I can understand.
The accent here was different from your initial contact with English?
Yes.
You said you had to learn about electric appliances. Had you ever seen a stove before?
No, never. We use charcoal stove.
You used a charcoal stove. And what about a toilet? Is that something that you had in a refugee camp?
No, we don't.
And so what is it like when you walk in and you see this device in the bathroom? Does somebody have to sort of take you through how you use it, or how do you learn those things?
Yeah, we had a cultural orientation in the camp, just only overview. But when it first arrived here, yes, the staff from the Refugee Resettlement Agency helped us to how to use it. They showed them how to use it. They showed them how to go, how to use, how to do things. So it is very helpful.
And I've heard, Sarah Pascal, that some people come here and they've never seen a bed before.
Yeah, they've had different types of beds overseas. And so oftentimes one of the things where we actually required to put in everyone's apartment is a bed frame. And many times they just take the bed apart and put the mattresses on the floor and try to mimic what they're used to. So it's very interesting to see the different cultures and how they interact and the pieces of American culture that people take on, but then also the pieces of their own culture that they prefer and that they keep and really kind of have that biculturalism going forward.
And Tuntun, you now work as a case manager for Interfaith Refugee Ministry. So you've gone through this process yourself, this cultural learning process, learning the language, and now you're helping other people who are brand new to this country. Where are some of the people from that you've helped recently?
From Democratic Republic of Congo.
Mm-hmm. And what are some of the challenges that they face that are specific to people from the Democratic Republic of Congo?
They are very similar because they lived in the refugee camps too, but of a different culture. So I don't think they have the challenges very similar to other refugee challenges too. I think they have the same problem as me at the beginning too. So I think, yeah, I'm very happy to help the refugees as a case manager and really proud of too. And I think they need a lot of help at the beginning. So I think the challenges for the refugee are very, very similar.
So what are some of the other challenges that they face in addition to just walking into an apartment, an American apartment, and seeing all these things that they've never seen before and don't know what they're for, how to use them? What are some of the other cultural challenges that someone would face arriving here?
Oh, there are many, many, many. Simple things like, how do you get where you need to go? Many have never even been in a car before, much less learned how to ride the city bus. A lot of our volunteers don't know how to ride the Wilmington City Bus. So, you know, they're learning everything in a foreign language. Listening to English all day, even if they understand some, is just very tiring. Things like we have a lot of complexities here that don't exist in certain developing countries, like leases and, you know, applications for things and using the banking system, writing checks, using credit cards. All of that is completely foreign, and they learn it, but over time.
And Tintin, just when it comes to the language, you've only been here 3 years now, which is not very long, especially compared to the number of years that you spent in a refugee camp in Thailand. You speak English very, very well, and I've noticed just in the time that we've been talking, you've also been correcting tenses, like you've been addressing English in this extremely proper sort of way. How long are you still working on English, or do you? What happens in your head when you do that? When you say they were, and then you change it to they are, or the other way around?
I'm still working on that, and I think I'm still learning English. So because it will not be perfect. At a certain time, it takes me a long, long time to learn a different language. Basically, I speak four languages. I think languages are very difficult to learn. And even if they're similar languages, for example, my native language is Karen, one of the dialects in Burma. And I had a lot of problems to learn Burmese. It is the same to learn English or to learn other languages. It just takes time, but I think learning a language is possible. It's not difficult, but it's possible. One day you can speak.
You said you speak four, so English, Karen.
Yeah, two different Karen languages.
Two different Karen languages.
Yes. Burmese.
And Burmese, okay. Yeah. So can you talk to, for people who aren't familiar with the cultural landscape in Burma, and by the way, do you call it Burma or Myanmar at this point?
Burma. Myanmar is changed by one of the dictator, and Burma is the name, a constitutional name, and Burma is changed by one person. Most of the people from Burma, we don't accept the name Myanmar. Even the current leader, Aung San Suu Kyi, she doesn't like Myanmar. So she used Burma. So.
Aung San Suu Kyi uses Burma as the name of the country.
Yes.
So you said there are two different Karen languages. Can you speak to the ethnicities that are in Burma now? And you are Karen?
Yes, I communicate in Burmese. They speak good Burmese or San Burmese. We can communicate with all other ethnic in Burma.
If you speak Burmese, you can communicate with all the other ethnicities there. Roughly how many different ethnicities are there in Burma?
There are 14 main ethnic minority, and altogether about 120. Small ethnic minorities in Burma, very diverse.
Very diverse. And do all of those ethnic minorities have different languages?
Yes, very completely different languages.
Wow. You're listening to Coastline. We're talking about life as a refugee in North Carolina and the resettlement process. With us today to answer your question, Sarah Pascal. She's the sub-office coordinator for Interfaith Refugee Ministries Wilmington, North Carolina office. We also have Tuntun, who is case manager for Interfaith Refugee Ministry here. He's also a former Burmese refugee himself. If you have a question for our guests, you can give us a call at 910-343-1138. You can also email us today at coastline@whqr.org. Sarah Pascal, why are we starting to see more refugees coming from the Democratic Republic of Congo?
Well, most of that has to do with things outside of our control. Burma has been the largest resettlement country across the U.S. for many years, I think more than 7 years now. And so most people are already resettled, and things in the Democratic Republic of Congo have not gotten better. So that's one of the processing centers overseas that is efficiently processing people out. Background checks are going quickly, and they're getting to actually travel quickly. So since we do have language capacity for that group here in Wilmington, many speak Swahili or Kinyarwanda as their native language. We anticipate that that'll continue to be a country where we see refugees from in the next maybe 3 to 5 years here.
And your fiscal year goes from October to September.
Correct.
So over the next, say, how many months? 6 months now, you expect how many more people to come in to this area?
Well, 71 have come this year so far. We're expecting a maximum of about 110. So potentially 40 more this fiscal year, but that it's not a quota. It's just the maximum that we would get. And then next year, about the same number, maybe increase very slightly.
Why is it that the State Department will decide that someone needs to come to Wilmington? And why are we not seeing an influx of Syrian refugees? Because when people think, especially today, when they think of refugees, so many people just see the video of, you know, Syrian refugees around the globe and this massive refugee crisis. And we're just not seeing that here. Why not?
Right. It is another complicated process. So once someone is approved to become a refugee and resettle to the U.S., the State Department contracts with 9 national resettlement agencies, one of which is Episcopal Migration Ministries. That's who our local nonprofit works with. We're an affiliate of Episcopal Migration Ministries. So those 9 national agencies get lists of people ready to travel, and they know the local capacity of their affiliates. So since Wilmington is a relatively small community, we've only been open since 2010 here. We're not a major city that has a lot of, you know, Arabic-speaking psychologists or Swahili-speaking teachers, or we're relatively non-diverse compared to other big cities in the United States. So that factors into it. Also things like housing costs, jobs that are available that maybe match certain populations better than others, opportunities for higher education or getting people's transcripts recertified so that they can work in their profession here. Wilmington is just in the beginning of stages of development of some of those things. And so in the future, I would expect that Syrians will be a resettlement population across the country, since there is such an upheaval of people in that region of the world. But in addition to that, places like the Democratic Republic of Congo and Burma and other places maybe are not publicized as much, or Colombia, but they have close to the same number of refugees as does the Syrian crisis. It's just not as visible to most of us.
Why do you think that is?
That is a very good question. I would venture to say it has something to do with just the availability of reporters to get to these remote areas in certain countries, but I don't know. Good question.
Tuntun, when you first came to this country, what was your first job?
My first job was the meat production worker at a turkey plant in Mount Olive.
You worked at a turkey plant in Mount Olive as a meat production worker?
Yes.
What was that like?
This is my first job. It wasn't my profession, but...
You started as a medical student.
Yes, it was not my profession, but it is a kind of job in the United States. It's hard. Many refugees work as a food production worker, especially meat production workers. Yeah, we have a lot of friends going together, had a lot of fun, but it was not my profession. I found a job as a caseworker here. It's my profession, so I decided to quit.
So is that a difficult sort of experience working in a meat production plant?
For me, it is not difficult because of you only need your strength. You don't need your brain. So it is just follow the direction. You can do that.
Sarah Pascal, what are some of the professional certifications that you would like to see people coming here? You know, they've been a professional in a particular, say, a doctor in another country. What kinds of things do we need to get going here so that people can work in their same profession here?
Sure. Well, certainly the medical profession. We've had a dentist from Burma that has resettled locally. We've had people that have been to some law school, but also the things that need certificates. So many of our people have had to flee without grabbing their documents. You know, their village is being burned down. I have to just go. I don't have time to collect my transcripts from high school. So some have had education overseas, but in order to access programs here, you might need your GED, or you might need to be here a year before you register at UNCW. So just making the programs that already exist accessible for our people that have different types of documentation, I think would be a great start. Things like truck driving licenses and welding classes and things that offer a good living wage that are stable over time, because people really just want to be able to support their families and make a good life here.
How many refugees come here as single people just fleeing by themselves, and how many are bringing kids? And we don't need exact numbers on this, but do you usually get a family, or is it always kind of a mix?
It's pretty much of a mix. I'd say about half and half, people that come with children versus just single people or married couples.
Tintin, you came here with your family.
Yes.
How many children?
I have 3 children and a wife.
And how old are your kids now?
23, 21, and 16.
Oh, so 2 adults and you're almost done with the third.
Yes.
Congratulations on that. You're listening to Coastline on 91.3 FM. We're talking with Tun Tun, a former Burmese refugee, now a case manager for Interfaith Refugee Ministry in Wilmington, and Sarah Pascal, the sub-office coordinator for IRM's local office. There's one segment remaining for you to ask a question of our guests. When we come back, we're going to talk to Susan, who volunteers with Interfaith Refugee Ministry. If you'd like to give us a call, the number is 910-343-1138. You can also email us today at coastline@whqr.org. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn for Coastline. You're listening to Coastline. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis Hilburn. We're talking with Sarah Pascal and Tun Tun, both of Interfaith Refugee Ministry in Wilmington, about life as a refugee and the resettlement process here in southeastern North Carolina. If you have a question about the refugee population, the refugee experience here in Wilmington, North Carolina, give us a call. It's your last segment to ask your question, 910-343-1138, or email us at coastline@whqr.org. And Susan from Wilmington, welcome to Coastline. You're on the air.
Well, thank you very much. Thank you for doing this segment.
Sure. I understand that you're a volunteer with Interfaith Refugee Ministry.
I am. I'm part of the parish sponsorship program. Our church, St. Andrews on the Sound, co-sponsors a young family, as well as I do ESL instruction. And all I wanted to do was sort of put a personal face on it. It's an amazing opportunity to invite everybody to, or anyone, to get involved. Sarah and Tun Tun can find little things or large things, whatever your interest or energy level. It's just an honor.
And you, Susan, are mentoring a family now?
I am.
Can you tell us a little bit about what that's like?
Oh, my goodness. It's amazing. I mean, you have the initial butterflies at first because you go, geez, I don't speak Burmese, I don't speak Kin, I don't speak any of the rest of it. And it really doesn't matter because generally they speak some English. And after a while, you really bond as family. I mean, I've been with them for, gosh, about a year and a half now. And it's amazing. You do whatever. You just help them. It's more of a family and a neighboring thing. It's not a financial responsibility. So you don't have to have money. You just have to have, you know, love and heart. And, you know, it's an adventure. It's an amazing opportunity to get to know them. They're, you know, it's just like having neighbors anywhere else, except these came from a long way off.
Can you give us an example of something that a family would need help with? You said this isn't a financial commitment. This is just about guiding someone. So do you get a phone call like, you know, how do you cook an American meal? Or how, can you take me shopping?
You sort of move into the cooking thing. Actually, the biggest need that they have, as Tintin and Sarah mentioned, sometimes it's just helping them read the malaise of forms that we have, like if there's a child registering for school, and just to sort of help them walk through all those forms that come home from school that, you know, Americans put in a pile, but they don't know, you know. I think the biggest thing initially is transportation, helping them just get to and from the store or to and from doctor's appointments. We do have a bus system, but sometimes it's, you know, there's no sidewalks, and if there's small children, it just can be problematic. So it's, you know, and it's not so much that you get a call, you might, but once you become connected and part of their lives, you and they have a common calendar. So, you know, their appointments are on my calendar, and that's just kind of how we go.
Well, Susan, thank you so much for sharing your story with us today. Thanks.
My pleasure. I just want to encourage others to just open yourself up. It is amazing.
Thank you so much.
Sure.
Sarah Pascal, can you speak to the volunteer army that you have? This is a nonprofit. What's your annual budget?
Very, very low. We only have 4 staff, and with 71 arrivals thus far, we are really doing the professional social work resettlement services, and we work with a whole cadre of volunteers, anywhere from 150 to 200 individual volunteers, in addition to, we call them welcome teams, co-sponsors, typically churches or other nonprofit organizations or student groups that we match directly with one refugee family as they're coming in. And they help, just like Susan said, with anything from setting up an apartment with donated furnishings before people come, meeting them at the airport, teaching them how to ride that city bus, helping kids with homework, teaching English, taking them to the beach. It's really up to that group to figure out how to welcome them to our community, and we're so lucky to have the support we do in Wilmington.
And we will, of course, put the information on our website at whqr.org when this is over, so if people want to volunteer, they can figure out how to get in touch with you. We have Clint from Tichy. Welcome to Coastline. You're on the air.
Thank you. Whom am I addressing? Sarah?
Well, you're talking to all of us. This is Rachel, and Sarah Pascal and Tintin are also here. What's your question?
I'd like to hear what we are doing or not doing about the refugees from Central America, primarily the unaccompanied minors coming across our southern border.
That's a great question, and Sarah Pascal, you're nodding.
Yes, that has been something in the works. The State Department actually opened up a new program. It's called the Central American Minors Program, where now if someone has a parent who's legally present in the U.S., they can do paperwork through our office to try to reunite with their minor child overseas instead of sending them on dangerous journeys across Mexico across the southern border. It has to be someone from Guatemala, Honduras, or El Salvador, and it's not something they can do on their own or through an immigration attorney. It actually does have to come through the Refugee Resettlement Agency. So thank you for that question, and if this applies to anyone, please do connect with us.
And thank you so much for your call, Clint. Do you have any idea, Sarah, how long it might be before this area would start seeing some of these people coming?
Actually, just before we came here, we have the first notification that one child will be arriving next month. That's the first one, and we did the application approximately a year ago.
And this child would be coming from?
I believe from Honduras.
Yes.
El Salvador. Okay, thank you for that, Tintin. You're listening to Coastline. We're talking about the life of a refugee in southeastern North Carolina, the resettlement process, why people wind up here. With us today to answer your questions are Sarah Pascal and Tintin. They are both with the Interfaith Refugee Ministry here in Wilmington, North Carolina, and Tuntun is a former Burmese refugee himself. If you have a question for our guests, we have just a few minutes left. You can reach us today at 910-343-1138 or email us at coastline@whqr.org. Tuntun, can you talk a little bit about the kind of success that people who arrive here as refugees find in Wilmington versus maybe other parts of the country or other parts of North Carolina, larger cities? Is it harder, do you think, or easier here for people?
In general, it is very the same, but it is compared to the other cities in the state. There are some refugees are successful here. They own a house. They own a lot of sushi franchises and many Harris Teeters. There are many. You can see
they own a lot of Harris Teeters.
Harris Teeter.
That's interesting.
Yes, the franchises at Harris Teeter sushi franchises.
I see.
Yeah, many refugees. They are also own a house, have a very good job, a very stable and good job. I think they love to live here.
And you actually said that when you first arrived here, Tuntun, you thought this was paradise. Do you still feel that way, or has anything changed?
Yes, has changed a lot.
And when
but we compared to the native people living here, we are not in paradise, of course, but it's a very safe place. It is very good place to start your life, not in a refugee camp, not in other countries like Burma, Congo. This is very different. We have a lot of freedom. We have a lot of rights. We can do, if you have a certain goal. So if you want to be a doctor for a child,
your daughter wants to be a pediatrician?
Yes, mm-hmm. not a medical provider. Mm-hmm. So she's on her path to go. I mean, if she well in Thailand, she couldn't do anything. Even if she has a dream, I mean, mm-hmm. Here is a very good place for refugees to reset her.
She would still be languishing in the refugee camp, even as an adult, if you hadn't made the effort to come to the U.S., you're saying. She wouldn't have been able to pursue any of that education or that medical professional.
Yes. There's only primary education in the camp. You cannot go further than that. You can only get primary education. So,
if you could dispel a myth for people, you know, and I'm talking about the white majority here that lives in southeastern North Carolina, in the Cape Fear region. If there's one sort of cultural obstacle if you could dispel that for people, it might help the refugee population a little bit more. What would that be? Let's start with you, Tuntun.
It is a difficult.
It is, yeah.
For me.
It's a hard question.
Yes, a hard question. I think if the can contact or interact with the refugees, that would be the best way, because I'm assuming that they will love refugees. Refugees are not the people who are giving problems for you. They will give you a lot of their culture, their origins, and they will be giving you fantastic experiences. So I would recommend try to
interact with refugees, because it will enhance your cultural experience, is what you're saying.
Yes.
Enrich your life. Sarah Pascal, what myth would you like to dispel that you keep running into doing this work?
I think one thing is that the term refugee is, you know, it's not a one-size-fits-all thing. Everyone has fled their country because of the same reasons, but it could have been any of us, anyone that has been in that situation overseas. So you can't paint all refugees with the same brush. There are some that will be very successful. Some, like any Americans, struggle for a little bit longer. Some speak English well, some don't. Some know how to use the computer, some don't. So just not stereotyping the group as a whole and treating everyone as individuals and as families like you would anyone else in our community.
And we have Kim from Wilmington. Welcome to Coastline. You're on the air.
Hi, thank you. Yes, it's a small world. I do volunteer through the Cape Fear Literacy Council. And I am tutoring through Millermont College the Burmese refugees.
So you're teaching reading then to English speakers, and you're also...
Yes, I'm an ESL volunteer tutor, and I am trying to teach the Burmese refugees English. And it is a very small world, because last week I was talking actually to Tuntun, because I was trying to help one of my students with some of the forms. And oddly enough, I ended up talking to Tuntun on the phone. So it is a small world, and I am helping the refugees by hoping to teach them English, speaking and reading and writing.
Well, that's great. Kim, thank you so much for your call. I appreciate you sharing your experience with us. Sarah Pascal, how long will Interfaith Refugee Ministry help someone who has recently resettled? Is there a time limit on that?
There is. The maximum we can serve someone is up to 5 years, but the heaviest time that we are involved is the first 3 to 6 months when everything is new. They need to be connected to mainstream services. They need help getting enrolled in school, finding a doctor, getting a stable home, getting a job. After those things are done, really the goal is that they're just part of our society, and so they get their services at the schools or at the health department or at community providers. We collaborate with pretty much every agency in Wilmington, but as needed, if there is a family that really has some difficulties, extenuating circumstances, we can be involved for up to 5 years.
And what might some of those extenuating circumstances be?
Well, for example, especially with our new Congolese population, single mothers, people whose they're widows at very young ages and maybe have 3, 4, 5, 6 children. So just the complexities of living life in the United States as a single mother with many children and maybe no English or no education, it takes longer to adjust.
And what kinds of services would be provided to someone like that?
Ongoing employment services, continuing looking for job upgrades to get economically self-sufficient. That's our number one goal, is getting people stable. Usually people start their first job within about 2 to 3 months of arriving in the country, and that could be that entry-level job, but we don't want to stop there. We want to connect them with the community college or the literacy council or places where they can gain skills. We also have vocational education through our office, and we collaborate with other agencies to hopefully over time they can get a better job and really pursue the goals that they have for themselves.
And you said earlier that there are 4 full-time employees at Interfaith Refugee Ministry. You're a small nonprofit. You rely on this army of volunteers. Where does your funding come from?
It's primarily federal funding. We do love to accept local community donations, but almost all of it is federal funding through the State Department's Reception and Placement Program, is how people come into the country, and then through the Department of Health and Human Services, Office of Refugee Resettlement. We operate a match grant program, which is an employment program, and the up to 5 years, the extended employment and case management services are through the North Carolina State Refugee Office, so almost all federal funding.
So none of this comes from local municipalities, none of it comes from the county? Is that something that's ever been discussed? Or
Not to my knowledge, not yet, no.
Tuntun, we are about to say goodbye. Do you ever see yourself going back to Burma, or are you here now for life?
No, not yet.
You're not there yet. Well, that's this edition of Coastline. Tuntun, Sarah Pascal, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for
having
us.
Thank you, everyone, too.
And remember, you can now hear Coastline twice a week on Wednesdays and Thursdays at 12:06 here on HQR News 91.3 FM. Coastline's executive producer is Cleve Callison. Our producer today is Claudia Thompson. Technical director is Ken Campbell. Aurora Shimshack is today's board operator. If you missed part of this episode, look for it at whqr.org or get the podcast from the iTunes Store. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline.